Hi, it's Steve Scherer. Thanks for tuning into our podcast. Hey, listen, you know, we come to you twice a year, ask you to support public radio. So since you're listening, would you take a moment, go to kuow.org and become a member. Thanks. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scherer. It's the Week in Review. Knut Berger is here. He writes for Crosscut. Eli Sanders is here. He writes for The Stranger. Joni Balter is here. She writes for Bloomberg View. Or Bloomberg Views. Now I've forgotten again.
No, View.
View.
We talked about this.
I know, we did. I always
your Bloomberger's one view.
That's right. That's
it might be heard. Bloomberg's view, though.
Yeah, sometimes it is, I'm sure. All right, so the mudslide is the big story. And this just to bring you up today it's the weather. 100% chance of rain, 20-mile-an-hour winds. It's working against the responders. Travis Hotz, the Snohomish County Fire District Chief in Oso, held a briefing an hour ago.
Areas that have dried out are going to become even more saturated with water. The areas that already have water in it that we've been working in, we'll see some additional, you know, water going to those areas. It just makes things slower and more complicated. We've got a hard day ahead of us.
Death toll is at 17. Officials say additional people have been recovered. And officials will have more information about that this afternoon.
There's a process that we have in place, and I don't want to get into too many details of that because, you know, this is a sensitive situation for people who have lost their loved ones. It's not as simple as just saying that, yep, this is the number of people that we've recovered. There's processes that we have that we're going through to get people to the medical examiner's office. The medical examiner's office is doing a great job, and they've got to do their work, and then they'll report their numbers when they're done.
You know, we're reporting on this, and we know it's about real people in real situations, and that's what makes this so tough to deal with. Sierra Sandsaver arrived at the scene of the Oso mudslide last Saturday to find a house in the middle of the road.
I just spoke to Governor.
But that's not her. This is.
It was torn to pieces. There was belongings all over the road, and everybody started showing up, and they started hearing a little kid screaming. And that's when everybody ran out there, and they found a 6-month-old baby.
She said the baby was blue.
Yeah, the baby was blue.
So that's the scene, and more scenes like that are going to be unfolding as this unfolds and the search continues. Just around with you guys, just impressions, your thoughts on this, on what you've been seeing and how you've been following it. Knut, you were talking about a picture you saw that sort of brought it into focus, like it did for all of us, I think.
Yeah, well, I when I heard about the landslide on the radio, my impression was, when you think about mudslides, you tend to think of the kinds of things that come down and block the train line or something that might take out one house or something. And I obviously this was bigger than that, but it really didn't hit me till the next morning when I saw the photograph on the Seattle Times homepage. I thought, well, this isn't a mudslide. This is a mountain that's collapsed. It's huge. The sense of scale came through. And, it's a horrible tragedy and very difficult for – would be difficult under any circumstances, but when you're in essentially a small town and you're – have volunteer fire departments and that kind of thing. It sounds like the response has been really good, but nobody is completely prepared to deal with a disaster, especially one as kind of complicated as this one.
Well, when they talk about how they summoned all the different agencies for response, they talk about this rolled out kind of slowly. It happened on a Saturday. The enormity of it was not known right away, just the fact that this huge, as you say, mountain had come down. But where was everybody? That was unknown. They didn't even know if they needed the state National Guard till a certain point. They didn't know if they needed the federal help. And you've seen some of the quotes about this were that the local folks had a hard time getting there at the very beginning, and then they didn't want to call in. They were reluctant, shall we say, to call in people until they knew for sure they needed that kind of help. And so there was a little lag there. And, you know, watching this story unfold, I can't help but wonder how mad people get at government. And yet at a time like this, who's coming in to help?
Friends and neighbors.
Friends and neighbors as well, yes. But, the coordination of it, the big teams are coming from government. So there's going to be so much gut-wrenching analysis of everything, that everyone did, but also of what was government's role. And we can talk about that in a little bit, about this Facebook exchange that caught my eye.
The friends and neighbors coming to help is obviously very powerful and moving, but friends and neighbors don't have the big trucks. That not everyone has a backhoe that they can lend. And so you do need the government to step in and help at a time like this. That's just the reality. You also need, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, the government to do what it can to prevent things like this. And there's been a lot of discussion about the decades of logging on the ridge above the hill that fell and the possible mismanagement of that area by the state and the widespread knowledge in the area that this was a hill that had its problems, that had slid before. So that's another role for government to play, to be aware of this and counter it, and also to evaluate, as I think Governor Inslee has said he's going to be doing, evaluate what it did and didn't do when something like this happens.
Here, we'll fix that mic. Somebody go tell Arvid he's on the air. He's testing a mic somewhere. It's one of the things that happens when we have multiple rooms for this pledge drive.
Oh. Wanted just to talk about the disaster response. I worked as a part-time FEMA worker for a while. And one of the things that's interesting is there's disasters that you can predict and ones that you don't predict. And we can argue about whether this was predictable or not later. But annual floods, hurricanes tend to be disasters that happen at certain times of year. So resources can be mounted to respond to those. There are other disasters that are unpredictable, terrorism, earthquakes, and something like a mudslide that just one day the mountain is there, next day the mountain is gone. So there's always a delay in response because people who know what they're doing have to get out, they have to see it, they have to assess it, and then everything has to, you know, run up a chain of command so that you can determine whether or not the state wants help. Do they want federal help? You know, and that system tends to operate very smoothly. But there are factors built into it. One of the things also to me striking in this is the way the local community has responded. Loggers going down, volunteering their heavy equipment, slogging, even determined to go in and rescue people or find bodies or do whatever they need to do, even when they've been asked to stay away. There's a very powerful sense of community responsibility that goes along with the government that can both help and hinder, but I think it's mostly a very, very positive thing here and I think an inspiring part.
All right. We'll come back to this and we'll talk about that Facebook exchange and we'll talk about that question of responsibility. You're listening to The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. It's The Week in Review from KUOW. I'm Steve Scher with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, and Dornfield's here. Feel free to weigh in, Ann. You have your release from your repertorial restraints for this hour.
I have no opinions.
just on that notion of responsibility, what is the conversation that you encountered, well, Joni Balter, on the Facebook
I don't
page?
Like to highlight things so cynical usually, but this one caught my eye, and it was this conversation on Facebook where somebody writes, "I'll bet someone who 2 months ago would have argued against government regulations restricting where you can build their home will be filing a lawsuit against various government agencies for not restricting them from building in such a dangerous area."
Maybe.
It could happen.
It could happen.
It could happen.
Well, what about there's been a lot of reporting from the Times, from the Herald, KUOW. There's been a lot of look into the reports that have been issued and even the efforts that have been underway from various agencies, from DNR, to see this as a hazard and try to mitigate against this. And it seems a little bit, when you look at it now, like mitigating was like the little boy with his finger in the dike. But what do we make from all those reports that have been sitting on people's shelves?
Well,
and engineers and geologists fighting.
It is complicated. It's too early to draw a conclusion, but I would say that it looks like a man-made disaster. It looks like, don't blame the weather, don't blame geology, don't blame physics. that this hill was seen as very problematic. There's been a lot of human activity on it for a long time, timber cutting, quarrying, other activities. DNR land, DNR permits have been issued for work. And there have been consistently over the years warnings about problems with this mountain falling down. And there's so many of them over such a long period of time that the suspicion is that, people ignored these problems or they believed that the mitigation they were doing was going to be effective.
Right.
You cannot go forward from this incident, I don't think, without a thorough vetting of what happened, how it happened, and looking at the processes going forward. Are we permitting logging? Are we allowing homes to be built in areas that are unsafe for those activities? And, whether the governor issues some kind of a moratorium or takes some sort of strong action to put some of these things on hold until we figure out what went wrong here, I think we're going to see a very long and tangled process of figuring this thing out. But clearly, there were very, very strong warnings that something like this could happen.
And when that's the case, it's also useful to look for a profit motive. Was there a motive that allowed people to look and see potential danger, but also see at the same time potential income, and that outweighs the danger in their mind and they move toward the income? That's what would be potentially the case if this hill was logged and logged and logged despite knowledge and warnings about its vulnerability.
Well, don't forget a lot of that land is controlled by – is managed by DNR.
Well, I would say
right.
The thing.
Well,
you know,
whether it's the state or the state allowing private companies to log on the land, someone is earning money off that. One of the, I don't know quite how to describe this, but if it's the state that is earning money off of the land, the money that the state earns on logging goes to fund public education, and so it's not your classic profit motive, but there does seem to have been a lack of oversight.
A couple of thoughts that I have. It is too early to figure this out, sort of in any clear way, but there are many, many factors. 16 inches of rain in this month in the Darrington area, and that's before this week, which all it did was rain. That's one thing. There were certainly a lot of reports left on a lot of shelves, reports that, really did warn of something like this, but that did not seem to prevent some of the activities were there. There was that one story that talked about a logging permit that it had been come in at 15 acres and then it was trimmed, but then when they finally did it, a little piece of it was still in what was considered a very sensitive area, and that allows the water to seep in. And they say these dangers after you do the logging can last 16 to 27 years like that. But also consider the pressures. In some ways, what the government was doing was trying not to get sued. There are pressures. I want to do what I want with my land. Think about the number that just came in yesterday on King County, second fastest growing county in the country. So there's pressure to build on a lot of places. And what do we know about the places that aren't built on right now? Are they similarly threatened? Is government just trying to make sure it doesn't get sued? What does March look like in all these places after it's been raining like crazy?
One of the things that was interesting was to look at how they did try to mitigate the toe of the slide by building a revetment and a channel. And it looked like all their efforts washed away in a few years, the DNR's efforts to do that. And part of it was to deal with fish, but part of it was to try to move that slide to the, I guess it would be to the west of where it seemed to be coming down. Again, it looked a little bit like they thought they were able to control a mountain with their efforts.
A mountain and a wild river. That river is very
cutting into the toe all the time, yeah. David Montgomery, who has spent a lot of time talking about this issue, the MacArthur genius geologist from the UW, has been here a bunch of times. He's everywhere. One thing he's talked about is that you have to look at the socioeconomic aspect of this, because that land, who lived on that land? Who could afford to buy that land? Who were those folks? That's affordable land for people. That's land that, people who don't have high incomes can afford and can build small pieces on. And that's another aspect of what government allows and where they allow it.
And also, years ago, this was, you know, much of what was built there were cabins that were only occupied perhaps part of the year. Now it seems like it's sort of more permanent housing, just like you're saying.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave that for a little bit. We'll switch to the Seattle minimum wage debate. All along, we have been saying that this was going to get more cantankerous and more divisive as the plans started to emerge and discussions started to happen. The big discussion by the mayor and his committee shows a lot of dissension between what should be considered, whether tips should be considered, who gets the wage, who doesn't get the wage in terms of small and large business. This is much murkier as we have moved closer to, I guess, debating it, right?
I thought that Ed Murray in the paper today sort of showed his hand a little bit, where he said we'll probably give a little on the total compensation thing if you guys surrender Dorothy on the phase in. Clearly, he's talking about a phase in of this.
Yeah.
That seemed one thing that I got out of what happened yesterday.
By the way, Dorothy, you mean from The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy?
Totally.
Okay, check it. I just wanted to make sure somebody wasn't taken hostage in this debate.
Or that she's got a nickname for Ed Murray that we don't know about.
I don't. Thank you for asking.
Joel Conley had a nice column about all that division that's taking place today. It sort of said, basically its premise was, don't think there's a single mind in liberal Seattle about this issue. Nick Hanauer on one side, Shama Sawant sort of trying to make a balance, Pramila Jayapal talking about how this is a woman's issue because of the wage discrepancies, and overall how little a person will be making even if they get, well, what our minimum wage is now, when they get $15 an hour, they'll be just kind of up above the poverty line. What do you think? Do you see this debate shaping in? I mean, it's just going to be more murkiness for a while, it seems.
I think so. But I think it's a good education for people, all of us, to learn about how complex these ecosystems are and, you know, that it isn't just a simple thing. And even though it sounds like it. And it's also interesting, you know, that the local aspect of this is something we're learning about the cost of living in different communities. You know, you mentioned that $15 an hour wage doesn't get up to what a person really needs to. I saw a figure this week that said, you know, it really ought to be $24 if you want to bring, especially for a, you know, single parent or something where childcare is needed. Other communities around the country, the cost of living is less. And so, I mean, one of the interesting things has been some people have felt this whole issue ought to be done at sort of the national level. There's also an interesting argument to be made that it's important to do it at these local levels, where certainly businesses do that. I mean, businesses, when they relocate people, they give people more money to move to someplace like Seattle. You get a higher per diem in your travel, or you get, you know, because people know the cost of living here is higher. Anyway, I just think it's very interesting to get into those details. There is going to be a lot of chafing because it's going to cost some people a lot of money. And at least at first, that's the way it's going to feel. And so I'm not surprised. I think it's good. I think it's healthy.
Another interesting aspect of getting into the details has been the making visible of a part of the city that is invisible to a lot of people in their day-to-day lives. There's a study that was done by the mayor's or the council's working group, whoever's working group this is, on the $15 an hour wage.
The mayor's.
Just released the study that was done by the University of Washington, asking the question, which no one apparently had the answer to, how many people in Seattle are working on minimum wage right now? Which is just, stop and think for a minute that we didn't know. until we started having this debate. And then the answer, it turns out, is about a quarter of all workers, or even as high as 30%, depending on how you're looking at it, I think.
Yeah, about a third of Seattle residents earn less than $15 an hour, compared to only 19% of those who work in Seattle and live outside the city. These are just different statistics along the lines of what you're talking about. 100,000 people working in Seattle earn less than $15,000, $15 an hour. And 40% of those working in Seattle earning minimum wage live outside the city, which goes to your point as well. Why is that?
I wish we could have done a poll before this study was released to find out what people would have guessed. I bet you would have heard a lot of people in Seattle saying, I think the people, excuse me, who are making minimum wage live outside of Seattle and commute in. And so it's really interesting to hear that it's the reverse. It's also interesting to remember that that study, the percentages in it are based on data that was reported in 2007. That was the last time the census was gathering this information in a useful way. And what happens after 2007? The financial crash.
Yeah.
So the numbers may be a bit different and even more striking now if they were available to us.
All right. We're going to take a break and think about the economics of this public radio station. Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. It's the Week in Review. Listening to The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. Eli Sanders writes for The Stranger. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. Joni Balter is the host of the Civic Cocktail at Seattle Channel. Knut Berger writes at crosscut.com as the Mossback. Also has a book out on the Space Needle and a collection of his columns, Pugetopolis. Well, we were talking a little bit about the $15 an hour minimum wage. Some last thoughts on that?
One thought was that I saw a piece written by Michael Reich, one of the authors of this Berkeley study that you see quoted in a lot of places about what would be the impact of raising the minimum wage. And he had a good point in there that gets to something we were talking about a little earlier, that it should not be surprising, he argues, that localities are taking matters into their own hands, because it's no secret that, for example, certain cities are just simply more expensive to live in. And so it's not surprising that maybe a San Francisco, a Seattle, Santa Fe, some of these cities would just go on their own and raise the minimum wage. Now, he didn't exactly come out and say, go to 15 right now, you know, no Swiss cheese or any of that kind of stuff. But he has said that, and they have very much studied San Francisco, which has a lot of rules on, you know, paid sick leave and all these other things, that when you, his argument is that when you raise the minimum wage in these cities, that up to a certain level, that it hasn't impacted employment. It's raised restaurant prices a little, which you would expect.
One very interesting corner of this debate that's coming up is the tip credit issue. And I am not even certain I understand it well enough to parse it on the air, but just to say that David Miner, who's a restaurant owner in Seattle, is going to be writing something in The Stranger next week, along with someone who has the opposite take from him on the tip credit issue, and they are going to duke
Jeff
it out.
Jeff Speer.
Jeff Speer, thank you.
15 Now activist.
Right. And they will hopefully untangle this, but this is another another contentious debate that emerges when you get way down into the weeds, or even not that far down into the weeds of the practicalities of implementing this.
Yeah, and The Stranger this week has Nick Hanauer and Eric Lee, who are partners in and arguing
about
Eric Liu, he's going to love that, arguing about that this is a benefit to everybody, especially business and the economy, when more money circulates. But of course, that takes us right back to small business, large business.
Well, their argument, which I thought was fascinating, and they've been arguing this middle out thing for quite some time, argues that if everybody has more money, then there'll be more money coming into the big businesses, but also into the small businesses.
Recirculates in our economy.
So that it may be, this is the rising tide lifts all boats routine.
Well, there's a lot of money that a few people have, and it's a little bit like hoarding, isn't it? I mean, there's all that money sort of stashed away, not necessarily circulating in the Main Street economy, as people were talking about when we had the Wall Street crash. President Obama is thinking about extending the sign up, which the deadline is, you know, next week, right? Or actually, sign up is March 31st for healthcare. And that is in part because they're still trying to get the young people to sign up. Is this fair that he keeps extending the deadline?
Well, they're definitely trying. They're definitely trying to get their numbers up because the 2014 elections look like, you know, a scary movie to some of them.
They are Democrats.
The Democrats are trying to get the numbers up, so it's not you didn't make your numbers. It's not nobody signed up. It's nobody young. They basically want everyone to sign up between now and Monday or this date that has slipped. And they have compared it to, like, if you're going to the voting booth and you're in a line and the polls close, doesn't it make sense to let the people who were in line before the polls close come on through and vote? But they've compared it to that.
Yeah. You think it's fair?
To extend the deadline?
Yeah.
Sure, and wise. The more people that you have in the pool, the better for the healthcare reform project. And they've been saying all along, I don't know how true this is, we'll see from the numbers, that young people tend to procrastinate more. And so they need more young people in the pool. The young people they've identified as procrastinators. One great way to catch the procrastinators that have waited too long is to extend that deadline just a little bit more.
Yeah, they're talking about, you know, if you get in now, if you start your application by March 31st, then you'll have
queue.
A grace period.
You're in the queue.
You have a grace period. I've heard critics say, "Well, this is Obama politics." I've also heard some people say, "Look, you know, 4 years from now is when we're going to understand what's working and what's not working in this healthcare.gov plan. And we should just back off on any of these deadlines right now."
And we're also seeing this strange phenomenon by which people root constantly against the success of healthcare reform. I mean, you would think that we would want to make this work in whatever way possible.
Yeah.
Well, part of the irony here is that the critics portray Obamacare as socialized medicine or as big government. The fact is, the way it was implemented has left it essentially up to the states to determine how enthusiastic they are in signing people up and leaving some of the heavy lifting to the government to fill in what the states aren't willing to do. Other states have been very aggressive and willing to dive in and sign people up. And in those states, things have gone extremely well. Overall, they've got, another 6 million or so people signed up. The polling on the benefits of Obamacare is fairly good. And I think the issue of the deadline slipping the slip the deadline a little bit. I think Eli's exactly right. What you want to do is try and give every opportunity. The real challenge, and I think the challenge that the government underestimated, was the difficulty in reaching people with a complicated message and having them understand. There are plenty of people who don't have insurance or who could save money who don't understand how to sign up. They don't even know about the deadlines. It's very difficult to communicate with a large percentage of the American people. I mean, it on anything. And this system has a lot of complexities in it. People don't understand how, if they sign up, but they can get a credit back on taxes and whatnot. It's just not clear. And I think that's one of the criticisms from both the left and the right, but particularly on the left, the people who are in favor of something like single payer. And I almost said simple payer, but my point is that one of the problems with the system is it's not simple enough.
Yeah.
It's not simple enough because it's tried to address the criticisms.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a challenge here because I had a question for the Washington website about my own health care, and I called up and they said, "You shall wait 30 minutes, which actually was 56 minutes. And not everybody's going to sit there that long, you know, able to do that and kind of hang in there to ask the question.
Well, that sounds like Comcast.
I talked to somebody who's trying to get their insurance, and they were talking to people at a couple of these different agencies to help them get insurance and also an insurer, and they didn't know. They were unclear about what their function was, what they should tell, what it was going to cost. So there's still a lot of the unknowns.
In terms of the life-changing impacts of getting through it and getting insurance, I talked to someone on Sunday who was at a soccer scrimmage that I go to, and I hadn't seen him in a while, and I asked him where he'd been, and he said, "Well, I didn't have health insurance, so I was not doing, you know, a lot of athletic activity for a year or two." And I said, "Well, how did you get it?" And he was able to sign up for Obamacare, and now he's back being more healthy as a result of not engaging in a risk that he can't, you know, support financially by trying to be healthy.
Boy, there's a lot of levels of intrigue in that. That's so interesting. All right. I want to bring in Luke Burbank, our Port Townsend correspondent, who is the host of LiveWire, which is on at 8 o'clock on Friday nights on KUOW, intermittently on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and the host of the TBTL podcast. Hello, Luke.
Hi, you guys. I just want to let you know that KUOW North is operational.
That's good. You're up. You're ready. I told you.
I've actually played in that pickup soccer match with Eli, and I had full insurance when I took part in it, and it almost killed me. Those guys are so good.
What were you doing there?
He was embarrassing my family.
It was impressive.
Just
how bad I was. No, I mean it's a real. I know this segment is not supposed to be about Eli Sanders pickup soccer activities, but it's a bunch of people who are really good at soccer. It's not just like a kind of couple friends who like to boot the ball around. This was legit. I'm just telling anyone on the panel, if he invites you to play soccer, really make sure you're bringing your A game
and your
or your insurance card
and your yeah. insurance card
right.
and your insurance
because you're going to need it for those knee injuries.
So indeed.
So Luke, I emailed you. Said you were the Verlin Klinkenborg of Week in Review. So he is the New York Times, former New York Times editorial writer.
Yes.
He wasn't the editor, was he?
No,
writer.
No.
And now he lives up north and in rural New York, and he gives us little reports on his ducks and his swans. So I was just wondering, just right off the bat, Luke, how's the alpaca farm going?
I have seen a few alpaca out here, so I haven't checked in with the owners, but I can tell you that there's a lot of wildlife that I'm not used to seeing in Seattle as up close as I'm seeing it here. For instance, there are about three eagle. Is it eagle or eagles?
Plural.
Eagles.
There are about three eagles that live just, I guess, maybe in our backyard.
In your backyard?
Wow.
Well, I mean, nearby, it's to the point where they just are flying around the yard all the time as if they were just crows or something. And here's what I'm learning about the eagle, and this makes it a perfect symbol for this country. Eagles are majestic and beautiful looking and pretty dumb.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. By the way, I like how all the people in Port Townsend and Chimicum Valley and all the places where KUOW comes in very strong, they're going, why are they acting like this guy's out in the boonies?
Yeah.
But it's just for the purposes of
yeah,
comedy.
Exactly. I was having some dinner the other night, and I was talking to a guy who co-owns one of the restaurants in town, and he said, you need to make this place into your own Lake Wobegon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I have to say that already I've noticed there are – this is a very – I mean, look, I'm talking to you on this studio link, so clearly Port Townsend is a high-tech town, but the people here are kind of moving at a different speed. I went to the hardware store the other day, and I was – walking at my Seattle pace of walking, which was I have to get where I'm going as fast as possible. And I was walking behind a Port Townsendite, which meant he was ambling. And I was getting really worked up about it. And then I realized it's okay if I get this little hinge that I'm buying, if I get it 30 seconds later than I was planning on getting it. So I'm trying to adjust to life here. And I do think there's a lot to talk about in contrast to Seattle.
He didn't turn around and say, whoa, slow down there, city slicker.
You know what I actually did? I cut down a different aisle and then raced up the aisle on the other.
So you made the 30 seconds up, right?
I did. So what I'm telling you is, it's about the journey for me. I'm not saying I'm there yet. I'm not on Port Townsend time, but I'm aware that I need
beat
to
the
adjust.
30 seconds.
Yeah,
sure.
I did.
Verlin Klinkenborg. What's on LiveWire tonight?
Very excited. We have Fred Armisen from Portlandia on the show tonight, and he was a really fascinating guest because he's well known for being on Saturday Night Live and for Portlandia and other things. He's also the band leader of this new late night show on NBC with Seth Meyers, but he used to be in a punk band called Trenchmouth that was going nowhere. And he did this for years and years of his life and was increasingly kind of disillusioned about it. You never hear anybody who's been playing music for a long time talk about the soul-crushing elements of playing music.
Yeah.
And he says being in a band is basically like being in some kind of weird moving company where you're just lugging gear around day and night. So it's a really fun conversation. I'm excited for people to hear it.
All right. Hey, Luke, we have to raise $2,360 in the next 3 minutes as you're, because of your public radio experience. Anything you'd like to say?
Well, I want to mention that KUOW North is not going to pay for itself. This is an incredibly expensive facility that I'm broadcasting from. And this really just talks about the sort of the footprint of KUOW, if you will. And all joking aside, I love the fact that being up here in Port Townsend, KUOW comes in clear as a bell. I'm listening to it as I'm driving around and as I'm working on things around the house. And it is, I have to say, even though I am a participant in KUOW, being on this program and doing Livewire, I enjoy KUOW so much. And there are so many afternoons where I'm doing something that's a little monotonous, but I've got KUOW keeping me company. I'm learning about the world. I'm hearing my friends who are there. And I mean like radio friends, because I don't know all the staff at KUOW any longer, but I feel like I know a lot of the people who I hear. And it's hugely valuable to my life. So if somebody is like me, and if you're somebody who takes a lot of enjoyment out of KUOW throughout the day, this is a perfect time for you to just throw a couple of bucks. I like the analogy Anne was using about it being like helping your friend move. This is very, very near and dear to my heart because I just moved up here. And the friends of mine who didn't carry any boxes are no longer my friends. So if you want KUOW to just, if you want to be dead to KUOW, essentially, go ahead and don't donate.
Yeah, don't donate. That's fine. All right, Luke,
talking to
thank you,
Kevin.
Don't be like Kevin. I bet Kevin's a pretty good guy. Luke's a good guy, too. All the folks who help make this program possible are good folks. And you, as a listener, I know you're good folks, too. So join us. Be a part of this community. Help us move this big vehicle of public radio down the road a few more miles. Become a member. Go to KUOW.org. And thank you.